This is Tony Herman. Today I'm interviewing Robert Burns for the oral history. This is September 16th, 2017. Robert, which branch of the military did you serve in?
Army.
And did you enlist or were you drafted?
Drafted.
Okay. Where did you grow up?
Parkville, Missouri.
Okay. Did you fight in a war?
Vietnam.
What was your experience like?
Highs and lows. The lows, of course, were the terrible destruction of human flesh. And the highs were, in my particular case, I returned a better person, I feel, than I was before I went. I was assigned to a unit that was out in the boonies, you might say, and was there for the entire time I was in Vietnam, except for a couple of R&Rs that I took. I was with the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment, and we were approximately 40 miles from Saigon. Some of this stuff I may not have quite right, but I'm a dentist, and I was drafted on Christmas Eve, 1965, after I set up my brand new practice in May and June of 1965, married three sons. I thought it was unusual to be drafted on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
So I called the lady at the draft board and I said, did you have to send those out on Christmas Eve? She said, oh yes, I had to send those out. I had to go out. And she said, well, you have a choice of when you want to go to basic training. You can go, I don't know, February or May. I said, well, I could choose to. Probably don't want to go to either one, but I guess I have to, so I'll choose May. So May the 1st, I went to basic training.
Where was that training?
At Texas, Fort, oh goodness, the medical, San Antonio.
Hood?
No, San Antonio is Fort, what is that? Fort Sam Houston. Fort Sam is the head of military, head of the medical area at that time. I think I took 6 weeks training, and I volunteered at that time to go ahead and see if I couldn't become airborne, because I was just a bit overwhelmed with things, and I thought, if I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it big time. Mm-hmm. So I said I'd like to, because I was a pretty good physical specimen at that time, playing ball and everything, and thinking of myself as being pretty tough. And I don't even know why I actually said I'd like to be airborne, but they said, well, there's no time for that. You need to go on to this unit and blah, blah. So I went on to my choice was, I had three choices. One of my choices was Fort Carson, Colorado. And so I went to Fort Carson, Colorado. And after I was there about a month, brought my family. I liked Fort Carson. It was a really nice place to be. I was a captain, because in February the 4th I was a first lieutenant, and my first day of active duty I became a captain because I was in the medical corps. Stayed there about 11 months, something like that, and then my commander said that I would be going to Korea and no family or anything. I said, well, look, tell you what, if I'm going to go, I'll just volunteer for Vietnam. And he said, you would? And I said, yes. So I volunteered for Vietnam. I left Fort Carson in March, where it's nice and chilly, and landed in Bung Tao, I think it was. Got off the plane, could hardly breathe. It was so hot and muggy. And it was just a realization that my life is going to feel slightly different. So a couple days later, a colonel, his name was Love, Colonel Love, called me and said, say, you're supposed to take a position with the 1st Infantry Division because their dentist got killed last week doing some thing with in an helicopter. I said, okay, that would be cool. I'll do that. And then the next day, he calls me back in and says, well, we've filled that position has been filled. So would you mind? He said, I remember that. Would you mind going to the 11th Armored Cav? And being a novice, no, I wouldn't mind. Well, you know, that's okay. But then I got thinking later, why would he say, would you mind? It must not be a good place. So off I go on a tank with no black vest, no helmet even. And I'm dropped off in a stand of bamboo saying that's going to be your location where you're going to be. And there were a few other people there. And so I was a little startled. And I was in the 37th Medical Company with the 7th Surgical Hospital about 80 feet across the street, quote unquote, with the 37th Medical Company spreading out not that many structures, but something like MASH you might ever think of. So anyway, the second day I was there, we were mortared, and I was awakened to the possibility that I could get seriously injured here. And I remember a patient that they brought in right in the tent where I was that had white phosphorus in his arm, excuse me, from a mortar, and the phosphorus was in his muscle, and if you cut off the oxygen to it, it'd stop boiling or burning your tissue. As soon as you take your whatever protective away from it, it'd start burning again, and it was just quite a stark beginning to my 362 days with the 11th Armored Cav. Do you have any questions or do you just want me to talk?
You're doing fine.
I remember that I was the only dentist, of course. I have a dentist and 5,000 men, mostly tracks and tanks and helicopters. And we were, the 37th Medical Company was in the base camp, but a lot of the guys would go out. We would go out on MedCap, DentCap missions. MedCap is a medical civil affairs program. We would go out to these villages surrounding the base camp, and we would do medical treatment of the people. But mainly the idea really was to gather information. And you gather information. We had Vietnamese ARVN troops with us that were assigned to us, spoke English and Vietnamese, and would interview people from the villages to find out what's going on and such things as that. And one time I remember I was helping with that, and I asked this gentleman what he did. He said he's a wood chopper. Really? He said, yep. In Vietnamese, the interpreter said, let me see your hands. Then he turned his hands over, and I had more calluses on my hands than he did, so I didn't quite think he was a true wood chopper, but I let that go. And that was one of the notes that was made, you know, finding out information and such. Mm-hmm. So I remember going into villages where it was, that I particularly liked to go to villages with children in the village. For example, there was a village, Cam A, which wasn't that far from our base camp, and there was a Vietnamese priest, Father John, that was headed up the parish or whatever it was. They had 600 Vietnamese children there that were basically orphans. And so that was my thing. I really liked to take care of those kids and go out and do whatever I could do. One of the things I did was write a letter home to my mom and dad, wife, and my in-laws and my parents, communicated with their friends, and I asked for some clothes to be sent over for children, mm-hmm. shoes and small children. Not knowing what I was doing, really, but the reaction was unbelievable. It wasn't too long, maybe 4 or 5 weeks, or maybe longer. Received these mail bags, which are about a little bigger than a 55-gallon drum. Probably 10 of those, full of clothes, mostly for children. And that was that made me feel really good, because I felt like I was a good soldier. I did my duty. I volunteered to be there. I wanted to be there to help my soldiers. And I discovered I really liked helping the villagers that needed help. Anyway, that was one of the programs we did, and I got a book from Father John with photos in it. I don't know how he did this, but praising Captain Doctor Robert Burns, as he stated, and sent that book to my wife somehow. And I still have that, which is a pretty neat thing to have. Besides trying to help the children, you had to be aware of these children, because some of the children weren't children. They looked to be 10 years old when some of them were actually teenagers and quite involved. And I caught one trying to do a satchel charge somehow on a track, and that was not a good thing. I remember Christmas. We had not a blade of grass at Christmas time. If I remember right, it was just dust about several inches deep everywhere, especially in the alongside the roads. It might be 6 or 8 inches deep. It's kind of like pumice, if you know what pumice is.
Yeah.
Very fine, very fine. And the helicopter pad was over by across the road at our intersection. And so the helicopter sometimes would fly over our mess hall and then land their helicopters. Well, you can imagine all that dirt in a helicopter and a mess hall. We had a lot of food that when you chew it, it was real gritty. I don't understand how that could happen. But that was interesting. And I went marching over one time to chew this helicopter pilot out, and I was the captain. I thought I was a big shot. And out comes the pilot, and he happened to be a major. So I said some bad things, then I said, "Sir," just to cover me a little bit after all that. And he said he'd try not to fly over there again. He didn't realize what he had done. Another instance, I went down to the mess hall, which was a tent, and this one of our cooks was making, I asked him, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm making pie, cherry pie, whatever cherry pie." And he was rolling out the dough with cherry pie, and the sweat was coming down, and it would reach the end of his nose, and he'd lean over and roll on this, and it would drip, and it'd go into the flour that he was mixing to make a pie. I remember that. That was quite something. I also remember that I didn't remember. I would, at first, when I was first there, I'd make friends with the young lieutenants as they're coming in. I'd make friends, try to be a nice guy with them and all this stuff. And they wouldn't last. They'd be gone maybe in a few weeks. You wouldn't have any lieutenant because lieutenants were prime targets. You lose lieutenants, and some of my best friends gone. So I would get to the point where I didn't make friends. I didn't even want to know anybody coming in new because I was protecting myself by not getting to know those young men. I had one particular friend that was, we always went out to this Kame village. And the guy runs in and he says, Captain Burns, you want to go to Kame today? And for some reason, I do not know to this day, I said, you know, don't think so today. You guys have to go without me because I'm going to stay here. And I've got things to do here at the base camp. And off they went. And about an hour later, somebody comes in and said, did you hear what happened? I said, no. So, well, my friend, Captain, is killed. He's a very close friend. He was in military intelligence. And it just crushed me. And I said, well, then I got to thinking, wow, I would have been there. I said, what happened? He said, well, they blew the track up. And so that probably would have been the end of me, at least the end of me in one piece. So I don't know why that happened. If you believe in divine intervention, that may be a reason to believe in it right there.
Right there.
The guys that I knew and ran around with, and the couple of enlisted people that were close to me, that worked for me, and I took really good care of, I lost their names. And I didn't know why, because I'm a pretty sharp guy at that time when I was younger. What's going on here? And of course I realized it's a protecting mechanism. I forgot a lot of stuff. I forgot a lot of names, locations, things that happened. And there's things I'd like to get rid of in my mind that I can't get rid of. A half track full of South Vietnamese soldiers, Arvin. They were called Arvin, Army of Vietnamese. Blew up on the road in front of me while we were going on track, and it just didn't disappear, but you can use that term. It just exploded from a 105 shell in the road or something. That was very traumatic. And another instance, we had a makeshift PX, a tent. Mm-hmm. I was in line to go into this tent because I was going to see if they had any comic books, because the night before, had a helicopter come in with a bunch of wounded and the really grotesque things when dead troops come in. Sometimes they're in body bags, a lot of times they're not. They're just laying in the bodies in the floor of the helicopter with arms and legs and very grotesque and death. And you can smell death. Death has a certain smell. And then you have the body bags and you just take those out and put them in a Connex, which is a big metal box, and close them up, and you deal with them later. Well, this one, two instances that particular day. One was, I was talking to this young man. He was sitting on a stretcher in the 7th Hospital, and I said, what's going on? How you doing? He said, oh, I'm doing really great. You seem to be just normal as a dickens. So I got hit with something right here in the back of my head. I got this little, it feels like a hole in there. I said, well, they're sending you down to the evac hospital down at wherever, Long Bend or someplace where the evac hospital was, because that's all the head injuries go down there. And he said, yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. And this guy was just totally normal, about 20, 18. And all of a sudden, he looked really strange and had some convulsions and such. And 10 minutes later, I mean, he was dead. And that was a terrible thing to watch, and it had to happen. And another kid comes in, and he has this boot about halfway up his leg with a couple of bones sticking out. And of course, he get rid of the boot, and he had some bad injury on his face. His cheek was just laid open. So the captain, the surgeon, says, "Hey, Doc, won't you work on his face? I'll work on his leg." Okay, so I go in, and I was pretty good at suturing because I had some practice before I went. I wasn't untrained. I had private practice, so that one reason they liked me out by myself taking care of people, because I knew what I was doing, I'd had experience. So I was about halfway through doing this meticulous repair of this man's face, because to me, you are your face. You're not your elbow, you're not your leg, you're not your butt, you're your face. That's who you are. And I wanted to do the best job I could, and halfway through, and that leg's already been off, enclosed and ready to move him. And so I still do the best job I can repairing the face, which also right after that I started trying to put together a protective device on the helmets of the track tank and track drivers. Mm-hmm. And it was simple. It was a football protective mask, just like on a football helmet.
Okay.
Because when you drive through tall grass, elephant grass that could be taller than the track, you hit stumps and people go forward suddenly, and what do? They hit their face on something. And they rip their face open, they break their jaws, they lose teeth, all these things. So I created, out of electrical wire, the black electrical wire that's about a centimeter across, you could bend it. So I bent these wire, put it on a helmet, made it like a person that wore glasses, for example, in other words, protect your eyes, and then lower, protect your face. And I took pictures of that, which I had the best camera you could buy, a Nikon Photomic TN 35 millimeter camera that I decided I was going to take pictures. Anyway, I took pictures and I sent it off to San Francisco somewhere, and about 6 months later I get a letter back saying they're working on something like that. Of course, they never to this day have done anything to protect the face, as far as I know. Maybe they have now. I've been out 17 years. 2000 I was out after 34 years of service total. Have never done anything about with that. But to get back to the story, the young man with the leg, I saw him like the next day, and he was still a little bit woozy. But he said, "Doc," I said, "yeah," this is what he asked me, "how much you think I'm going to get for my leg?" I was just shocked. I'm thinking, well, this guy's not, he's not realizing what has happened to him and his life. And so I told him, "well, I don't have any idea, but I'm sure you'll get some compensation from the VA, and they'll fix your leg, give you the best prosthesis that they can come up with, and you'll be taken care of. I can tell you that." And I said, "what do you need anything?" And he said, "well, maybe you go down to PX. They might have some Dells. Get me a Dell." And I think he said Dell. And I said, "okay, what's a Dell?" He said, "Dell comic books, you know." And I said, "oh, yeah, okay." And that made me think, wow, I better reevaluate. I've got 20 years education, and this guy's from Mississippi. He's probably a high school dropout or something. And here he is, he doesn't know what's going on. And I didn't know basically what's going on. And who did know what's going on? I still don't know. But that's why I was standing in the line. at the PX.
Okay.
Waiting to go in. 15 feet down the line towards the door, two guys. In the base camp, later on, when you carried your weapon, you took your ammo out. At that time, everybody had ammo in their weapons ready to go. These two guys, buddies, quote unquote, found out later, they're buddies, same unit, same tent, slept in the same tent, such, started arguing. And they got louder and louder, and pretty soon this guy whips up his M16 and puts it right about on the tip of your chin to that guy. And that guy's got a big smile. I was watching, this guy got a big smile. I was almost going to interfere, but I thought better of that. These guys are loaded weapons. He said, "You wouldn't do that." He looked at my cat. Boom. This guy shoots his buddy right, pull the top of his head off. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you it's a pretty stressful situation at that time. And that was stressful. And why was it stressful? These guys, if they're in a tank, it's five crew members, and you get hit by an RPG-2 or an RPG-7, which is an anti-tank weapon, what that does is make a hole about the size of a dime on the outside, and it'd go through 7 inches of steel. But what it would do is melt all that metal and come out a little bit larger hole inside and spray the entire area inside the tank with molten metal, and which could be somewhat painful if you got hit in the right place, or wouldn't be painful if you got hit in the wrong place, because you would be dead, you see. So that brings me to the why am I in the field with these guys. I'm a dentist. I'm a dentist captain. I ride around and I go out half the time or more in the field with these units. That's because the commander of the unit, who was a colonel, said this. If we have a, he said one of our big problems, dental problems, whether it's fractures or whatever, it's a big problem. And in our tracks, in our tanks, we got five people. If you lose one, you lose the track. You can't operate properly with four or three people in a tank.
Okay.
So you, Colonel Burns, you're going to go out with, bring your stuff. You've got field stuff, right? I do. Yeah. Bring your stuff, go to field. You can fix these guys up best you can in the field. Because if they have a problem, it takes a day to take them back to a station and get them, and then it takes another day. The next day, they get fixed, if they're lucky. And then the third day, they come back to their track. Well, what'd they do? They just lost 3 days on that track, that tank. Well, the guy made sense. Okay, I understand. Of course, I'm going to do what I'm told anyway, but
yeah.
I was kind of comfortable with it. I thought, this is okay, I can do that. And that was quite interesting for a dentist to be carrying on the back of the track an M79 grenade launcher, which is looked like a rifle with a big tube. I carried that, and I had my M16 that was assigned to me. And as an officer, I had a 45 automatic shoulder holster that I would carry. So I looked like the real combat guy, and at times I was, but it was just so unusual. I only met one other dentist ever that was in the Vietnam that had a situation like mine. I ran into him on an airstrip. I was going someplace and he was coming in, and he was with some airborne unit. I told him, yes, but I was going to be airborne. He said, well, I'm not airborne, but I'm with him. So, and he told me he was doing the same thing that I was doing, out in the cup boonies and doing stuff. So, as time goes by, I get a chance to go from, you can tell me when I got too much time.
Oh, we're fine.
We're fine? Okay. the colonel comes out to the base camp, and he told me that nobody liked to come out to that base camp because it was too dangerous on the trail coming out, because you get blown, and that happened all the time. Nobody really got upset except one day, the same time the Colonel Love came out, that the convoy was hit, and everybody said, that's all right. But they hit the beer truck. Oh, you sure heard these guys. They were upset, hitting the beer truck, and two pallets of beer was gone. And that was important.
Priorities.
I couldn't believe it. Well, that's funny. I got to get a picture of that. I'm sure I do somewhere. Anyway, the colonel says, you've been here 6 months. You're allowed to go back and be at Long Bend if you want to. I said, nope. This is my unit and my people, and I built this Quonset hut with concrete floor, dental clinic. I built it. I talked to these engineers to coming in and doing this. And then we built a water tower out of myself and my assistants, out of culvert. We put the water culvert put together, poured concrete in the bottom of it, put a pipe. We had no way to bend. We run against a tree. It was just a piece of pipe that was about 20 feet long. We run against a tree and keep bending this pipe till we got it just right where we come out of the tank of water and into the building, into a stainless steel sink that I had made. And then we bartered for some paint, and we painted the floor glossy gray. This place looked nice. When these young guys would come in, they'd want to take their boots off because it was really, kept it really nice. And it was a pleasant place to be if you can think of visiting a dental office as being pleasant. We made it as nice as we could. So that was interesting. My commanding officer when I left was George Patton, who happened to be a Colonel George Patton. He was, I think, his grandson or great-grandson of Patton. Hmm. He took the place of my old colonel, I can't remember his name, who was a really big guy, 6'6". We flew out on some helicopters, and we all got off the helicopter, and we were walking to an area that didn't look very safe. They had these holes in the ground. They'd pop up and hit that colonel four times in the chest. Of course, we lost our commander. That was kind of interesting. Nobody should have landed there in the first place, but that's another story. So that's why we had Colonel Patton. What else? I don't have...
What was it like coming home?
Oh, okay. That's interesting. You'd ask that. So I'm going home. Short timer, they called you. A short timer, you take your shirt and you cut it off and make it shorter and shorter and shorter. Your t-shirt. Pretty soon all you had was armpits and shoulders and very short in front. And you were a short timer. Everybody knew it. Okay, well, you're going to go home, and it's March, so I'm going to give you a field jacket. Well, they gave me this field jacket that was at least two sizes too small, and I was like 31 inch and 180 pounds. I was in shape, and that jacket was about 4 or 5 inches short of my wrist, and it was dirty, but that's what they had, they said. So I leave, I go down to Bontal or Benoit, go down to Benoit. It gets rocketed while I'm taking a shower. I run naked into the bunker. Everybody's looking at me like I'm some kind of wacko. Well, I'm from out in the boonies. I know this stuff's bad stuff. These guys act like there wasn't anything going on. So that was kind of embarrassing. But I come home with this short jacket. I get to San Francisco. And in San Francisco, they herd me around to a place, and they tell me that you're going home tomorrow, and you're going to wind up in Springfield, Illinois, not Kansas City, because my family was in Springfield, Illinois. My father-in-law, my wife and kids, my mother-in-law were all there. So, I make a long story short, I get to Springfield, Illinois, and after two or three days of no sleep, I get there, make my family meet me and go to their home. I fall asleep on the stool before the bathroom, and I fall asleep. I remember that. Then I go back to Parkville, and I'm there for a couple of months before I get a phone call. Colonel, whatever, says, Captain Burns, yes, you're supposed to be at a reserve meeting. I said, no, I'm out. I got released in San Francisco. I said, no, they didn't tell you, I guess, that you have a 4 years of reserve duty to do or whatever it was. I said, no, they didn't tell me that. I said, okay, I'll be there. And so I go and start my reserve years, which I 32 years I spent in reserves. It was a good program. But when I came back, March of 67 to March of 68, so in March of 68, what was going on in Kansas City?
Riots.
I come back to that. What is going on? I mean, these people, they must be nuts. They don't know, have any idea what kind of country they have. You can protest, but let's don't burn things up. That was one thing. The second thing is, I'll start coming to the meetings. Well, don't wear your uniform to the meetings, which is right here in Independence. You know, I went there for years. I said, don't wear your uniform? No, people don't. Are anti-military, so don't wear your uniform. Unless, of course, you want to. You have a choice. I said, well, I'm wearing mine. So I started going to the meetings. And I did get this stuff, like, baby killer spit on you stuff. You heard that. Well, I don't think I was called a baby killer, but I was looked at as though I was the enemy rather than someone who served their nation, you know. But I would challenge people because I didn't agree with them because I didn't really know yet how this Vietnam thing was so political. I didn't know it at the time. I was just a soldier doing my duty. And I stayed in the reserves. I became in charge of all the dental activities in four states. I traveled all over the world with the military, all over the United States, and doing good things for the troops and a lot of good things for the public. Became a colonel in 1984, so I was a colonel for 84 until my retirement. At one time, I think I was senior colonel in the Army Reserve. I was on the list to be a brigadier general. Clinton, I think, downsized the Army at that time, and my slot, which was an 07 slot that I was going into, meant 07 meant brigadier general. I was an 06 colonel, and I was opportunity to go into that slot, but they downgraded the slot to an 06 slot, which was really bad to do because I knew that needed to be an 07 slot. And I just said, no, I'm not going to do that. It would cost that slot, if you did it properly, it would cost you about $60,000-$70,000 out of your own pocket a year to get around to these different units all over the United States. Mm-hmm. Because at that slot was the deputy commander of the MedCap, of the medical facilities in the United States Army. It was the highest dental position and also deputy commander of the medical. So it's a very important position, and you had to do something with that position, and it didn't pay you enough money to do it. So I said, no, I'm not going to do it as a 06. I was getting to the point where I just like to do my local stuff. not be away from home. Because mm-hmm. I was away from home every Wednesday night, 1 weekend a month at least, 2 weeks in the summer was the absolute minimum. And then I would travel sometimes on weekends to go visit these units. So I spent a lot of time military. My family suffered from that, I think, in retrospect. But I was always supported. Never a time that I wasn't supported by my wife and my children. Nobody said a negative thing to me in my family, or they always supported my military things that I did. And at the time, I felt this was great. They supported me, and I was doing things to help, and I had a great military career, and now I have TRICARE for life. Medicare, TRICARE, I'm set.
You're set. About the story. Set. So what words of wisdom do you have for future generations?
Well, I'm into education. I'm involved in the Park Hill Education Foundation. I was 9 years on a trustee at Park University, and I'm on the, my dad was on the school board, so I'm kind of into education. Education in this country right now is not what it should be. If you ask any young person about Vietnam, they don't know what you're talking about, most of them. Some of them don't even know anything about World War I. They don't have any education, history. They don't understand how important history is. There needs to be a changing of the ultra-liberal teachings which are in our high schools and in our colleges. There needs to be a little bit of a shift so that these people have more interest in history. That's one thing. And get your education. You're not owed anything. And people are a product of their own decisions. Well, I didn't get to do this. I didn't do that. Well, why didn't you? You're a product of your own decisions, and you made some wrong decisions. But today is a new day. Start making the right decisions and go on forward, especially with education. And there's a lot of individuals instead of groups. There are a lot of neighbors that don't even talk to each other. There are a lot of people, especially young people, they're scared to death that somebody's going to kidnap them or something because of all the media. The young people aren't friendly anymore. When I was 10 years old in Parkville, I could get on a bus, Greyhound bus, go downtown Park, downtown Kansas City, get off the bus, take a streetcar out to the Nelson Art Gallery by myself. Nobody worried about it. You get up in the morning in the summer and you go out and play, you'd be gone all day. And at supper time, somebody rings the bell and you come home. Nobody worried about you. You learn things. You learn people. You learn something about people. That's the hardest thing to learn about, is people. I don't know. I feel like that I'm an old guy saying, well, those kids, that generation of kids, they're just not going to make it. That's been said since time began, probably.
Yep.
But it seems like today there's, for example, I talked to a guy yesterday who wanted to interview some people for a job. And he pays well. He said, today, somebody calls and you give them an appointment for an interview for a job, and they don't show up for the interview for the job. Now, what kind of person is that? We have a bunch of those people out there.
Yep.
What are they going to do? Only 33% of the people in the United States have any savings for retirement. $10, $100, $1,000. That is just live today. Someone's going to take care of me. Seems like there's a lot of attitude like that. Well, nobody's going to take care of you but you, number one. Now, you're on the Army, you expect your buddies to take care of you in a bad situation, and they do. And they expect you to take care of them in a bad situation, and they do. But out in the real world, it seems like there's none of that. There's no buddies out there. It's just acquaintances. And you have a lot of acquaintances, but if you have one real friend, you got something. Maybe a few years ago, you could have two real friends. It seems like today, it's harder to get a real friend that you can call at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, hey, and he's right there.
Right, sir. Well, I'd like to thank you for sharing your story and thank you for your service.
You're welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.